Hello, and welcome to AARC Perspectives, where we talk with members of the respiratory care community and learn about their experiences caring for patients and building the profession. I am Doug Lair, Chief Operating Officer at the American Association for Respiratory Care, and I will serve as your host for today's episode. Since 1947, the AARC has been leading the effort to advance the respiratory care profession and promote high-quality, cost-effective, patient-centric respiratory care. The respiratory care profession is ever-growing and evolving thanks to dedicated respiratory therapists around the world. Joining me today on AARC Perspectives Podcast is Dr. Linda Goodfellow. Dr. Goodfellow is a registered respiratory therapist and the Director of Clinical Practice Guideline Development for the AARC. She completed her bachelor's degree in respiratory therapy from the Medical College of Georgia and her doctorate in adult education from the University of Georgia. As CPG Director, Linda is assembling teams of content experts in respiratory therapy, medicine, and other relevant disciplines to review the known literature about pressing clinical issues. On a personal note, Linda lives in Peachtree City, Georgia, and has three grown children, all boys, and now has three grandsons. Enjoy my conversation with Linda. Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to AARC Perspectives Podcast. It's my pleasure today to have Dr. Linda Goodfellow with us today. Dr. Goodfellow is actually an employee of the AARC and is the Director of Clinical Practice Development Guidelines. Linda, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Doug. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, I am too. And I think that the topic that we want to discuss today is going to be super important for our listeners. I know how important it is for the science and the practice of what we do in our profession. And I think it's just going to be a great 30 to 40 minutes for us today to talk about. So before we get started and talking about what we brought you on today, maybe you could just start by telling us just a little bit about yourself and how you ended up at the AARC.
Yes. Well, first, I'm happy to be part of the AARC in a more formal way as opposed to a volunteer, as I was for many years. But I joined the AARC in October of 2021, and I was, you know, I had been at Georgia State, and I am still there in a very small capacity. So I have access to the library and other resources that are important for CPG development. But I was looking for a new challenge. I was looking for something very different. I was in administration and was just needing a different challenge, I'll say again. And so this really was something that really struck me whenever I saw the announcement come out. And so fortunately, it all worked out and I'm now here. And this has been just a great experience for me thus far. It is challenging. There's no question, but I'll go into some of the detail. I hope you'll be able to kind of get a feel for how we're trying to change evidence-based practice in respiratory care, how the next generation of RTs will be practicing, and therefore they need to know evidence-based practice and how it is created and the recommendations and what do you do for them. And so there's and also for retention in the profession and moving the profession forward. So there's many, many reasons that this was appealing to me. And I'm hoping that I will be able to do this justice as we go forward. But it has been a wonderful experience thus far, and I'm happy to be in this role.
Yeah, and we're happy to have you here. Just to give our listeners a little bit of background, in order for respiratory care to compete in the healthcare marketplace, so to speak, our credibility really lies within the science and the research that we publish, and that's why it's so important that we have the Respiratory Care Journal. But to take that one step further, it's imperative that we practice based on evidence-based standards. And historically, prior to your arrival, Dr. Shauna Strickland, who is our Associate Executive Director of Education, was the one who was leading our efforts with clinical practice guidelines. And we simply identified that that has to be its own job, that it couldn't be something that was just rolled in to somebody else's job duties. And that for us to be successful in these endeavors, that we really needed to create a new position and start publishing clinical practice guidelines with a bit more regularity and frequency. So, Linda, I'd love to ask you the question, and maybe the most simple basic terms, especially maybe some of our early professionals who are listening today, maybe you could talk just a little bit about what exactly is a clinical practice guideline and what is evidence-based practice?
So the CDC actually has formulated a definition for clinical practice guideline. And the CDC calls guidelines that or that they are issued by an authority. For instance, the agency of our federal agencies like the CDC, they may issue or seek clinical practice guidelines on particular topics. And professional organizations do the same, and that's where the AERC falls. So we're looking for recommendations for clinical practice and also for policy. So I'll get into this more about how CPGs will be used from the AERC in a little bit. But just to start, that's where the original framework, as well as the Institute of Medicine, they were all together in creating definitions for clinical practice guidelines. But from the guidelines are recommendations, and that's the product or the outcome, if you will, of a clinical practice guideline. And these are statements that can define specific preventions or treatments or policy actions. And it is scientifically based, meaning that a literature review of the known medical science literature is reviewed. And it is graded for how strength or for the strength or how rigorous the evidence is presented, which looks at the methods. It looks at, you know, the people who are part of that group and their, say, qualifications and what they bring to the table. And it's not just physicians or other clinicians. It's respiratory therapists, nurses, of course. But you know, I'll give a little primer here. On one of our groups, we have two patients that are part of our group and are just invaluable to us in giving us a perspective that none of us have. And so that's important for clinical practice guidelines. And then, of course, we will present some summaries to kind of so that our readers in the journal don't have to read everything that we are reviewing, but we'll kind of summarize the evidence as well. So that's where we begin, I'll say, with the structure here of how to perform evidence-based practice guidelines. I know that in the past, there, and really since 2002, the AERC has had a form of evidence-based guidelines that have been produced. And you know, you mentioned Dr. Shauna Strickland. I don't know how she did all that as well in her role as a former associate director for education, because she had a lot of things on her plate. And so, and one of them was clinical practice guidelines. So I give her credit for getting the CPGs out in the past couple of years in particular. But we are moving away from expert panel guidelines, where back in the 90s, when the first CPGs were produced, those were really experts in the field that came together, and they reviewed the known literature at that point and sort of put down indications, contraindications, adverse events or potential adverse events, and, you know, kind of the pros and cons of the topic. But it was not as rigorous as what we are doing today. Evidence-based practice was just sort of first presented by the Institute of Medicine back in the early 90s. So, and Dr. Dean Hesse was the first one to publish a clinical practice guidelines by what was, you know, somewhat best practice at the time. It was 1992 on a pulse oximetry CPG that was published. And so things are changing. And I want my fellow respiratory therapists to know that these will take a little longer than just a literature review because of the methods, and we'll go to that. But these will take a little longer to come to publication. And we're hoping that it's not just a guideline that we will put out, though, but other things that will be developed, maybe a best practice document, or it could be some instruments for scoring as you do your work. So, you know, there's other things that will come from the clinical practice guidelines because we are going in so deeply into the topic. And there are so many, there's just so much information that we'll be able to provide and then how to use that. But it won't be a policy for you and it won't be a procedure anymore. It will be other things that are in the end much more valuable than just how to do something, but it'll allow you to actually use this in practice and also promote and move the profession forward, which to me is one of the overarching goal here that I have.
Yeah, I think that you bring up some important points. And, you know, for the last three decades, the ARC has been publishing these documents, guidelines to really support the respiratory therapist in the community and how we practice what we do. But I think it's important to note that, you know, three decades ago, we were doing expert panel reviews versus now these are true clinical practice guidelines that are based purely on the research and the published research and the evidence and grading the strength of that evidence. And we talked offline before we started this recording. We still get very frequent phone calls from our members wanting to know if they can publish our current clinical practice guidelines as they did back in the early 2000s in their policy and procedure manual. And that's really not what the intent is for these documents. Can you, at a very high level, talk about the methodology of that we could do weeks of discussion about this in and of itself, but like a 50,000 foot view, what's the process? What's the methodology of really starting to create a clinical practice guideline?
Yes. So fortunately, one of the first things I did when I took this position was I took a course on clinical practice guidelines development. This was out of McMaster University. It was an online course, so I didn't have to go to Canada to take the course. It was probably about 4 months. In other words, we had some content presented, and then we actually had to do a lot of homework. And actually, I have passed the course, but I'm not certified yet. And that is the goal here, is to have a certified methodologist. And what I'll need to do in order to tick off that last box is to actually submit our clinical practice guidelines. I had to submit three of them for them to actually grade. And hopefully that will be possible. But I think it's going to be possible just because of how we are meticulously going through each step by step. And so there's a lot of different tools that we're using that have never been used before. So not just the methods are different, but the tools that we're using. And some of the tools are where I'll use an example of EndNote. A lot of us, most likely, if you're at a university at some point or in a college, at some point you had to go to the library and look up references, and then you use those references as part of your papers or manuscripts. But an EndNote program is very helpful in kind of managing those references. So that's a tool that we're using. There's also another one very similar called Covidence that is a reference manager. We're also using a new tool called Cochrane RevMan. Cochrane Library, we're all familiar with. It's a repository of clinical practice guidelines and then just, you know, thousands and thousands of manuscripts. It's very similar in parallel, I'll say, to PubMed. But with RevMan, they have a portal now where you input data from articles that are related to your topic that you have screened, and you know that, hey, this is an article that can provide evidence, perhaps, for this topic that we're searching. So I'll give an example here. One of the first team was on patient ventilator assessment. That's a question that I was getting. In fact, once it was announced that I was to be the new director here, the very first question I got was from someone asking how often to do a patient ventilator assessment. And the term was not patient ventilator assessment, it was vent check. And we are trying to get away from that term because we, as respiratory therapists, we need to think, is it not just a task, but this is an assessment. And that's going to require more critical thinking than just, you know, looking at a knob and writing it out a number. You know, what is the patient telling you about their care from the ventilator, and on and on and on. So we're using these tools here where we'll input the data and it will summarize this for us in a table that we then will use to determine if the data presented is perhaps biased in any way, or is it inaccurate in any way. You know, we look at the publication bias and imprecision. And there's a lot of things that we are looking at now that most likely were not looked at heavily in the past. I'm not familiar with everything that the past 10 years or so the CPGs did, but and they did use some external tools to review articles and data, but these are internationally known tools to use. And that's also a new thing that we're using. And so from these tools, though, GradePro is another one. Again, these are GradePro is housed in Europe, as well as GIN, G-I-N, the Guidelines International Network. So there's a lot of different organizations and opportunities that the AERC has to learn, to be a part of, and to access from the new methodology that we're using.
Lots of very sophisticated tools that you're using and have at your disposal, not to mention the team of individuals that are working on this. I love the fact that you had mentioned earlier that you've even incorporated some patients onto these teams, which is, I just think is incredible. You had mentioned the one clinical practice guideline that's currently in development, patient ventilator assessment. Are there others?
Yes. So with the AERC strategic plan that's underway now, I am to have three different CBG teams or guidelines a year. And that was something we were already planning last year before the strategic plan, but it just dovetailed right into it. So the patient ventilator assessment is our first one. And then we also have another one. The second one is spontaneous breathing trials. And this topic is very interesting, how we came about this one. Because remember, the first one I said, I actually got an email from someone asking the question. For the spontaneous breathing trials, the ATS, they produced a ventilator liberation guideline themselves a couple of years ago. And it is very good, very comprehensive, and very rigorous. But one of the things that they didn't mention, but they never went into detail, was the spontaneous breathing trial. And so one of the things Dr. Hess mentioned is, you know, when you're looking for topics, if you see a CPG from whoever it may be, whatever organization, ATS or whoever, if there's something that they didn't include or go into detail that it relates to respiratory care, maybe we should pull that out and look at it. And it would enhance you know, the ventilator liberation CPG that the ATS has. And so that's what we have done. That's how the spontaneous breathing trial came about. And I was fortunate to ask the head or the lead author of that CPG, Dr. Timothy Gerard, to join our team as a consultant, as well as Dr. Neil McIntyre, because he's been writing about ventilator liberation and weaning and those topics for years. And so those two were just the perfect consultants in my mind to have join us. And then we also have other, you know, all respiratory therapists that if they're not physicians on this team. I will say we do have a librarian that is on each team that helps with the literature reviews. It is Mr. Joel Gogowski. As I mentioned, I need access to a high-powered university library with this job. And Joel is a librarian that I have known there for a number of years. And he's been delightful in this new endeavor in joining us.
Can you talk a little bit about the role of the librarian? I think that a lot of us, and unless you're on a university, you know, a lot of us don't even go to libraries anymore. And our reflections of libraries are what it was like when we were in college or when we were a child and we went to the library with our parents and so forth and so on. But you had mentioned the role of the librarian, and I want to make sure that that's not overlooked. Could you talk about how critical and how important it is to have a librarian as part of this team?
You couldn't do this work without one. You know, like I mentioned, Dr. Strickland and the previous CPGs, there were librarians on the, so I will say the last five CPGs that were published before I came on board. So we have been using librarians, but their role, they are experts at, you know, casting a wide net on a particular topic. But if you give them a few key words, and this is one of the reasons why we see at the end of all journal articles that there's a key word list, or at the end of the abstract, actually. And these words are then put into a librarian language called the MESH, M-E-S-H. It does stand for something, and right now I don't have that in front of me, but that's the Boolean language where they, you know, this term and another term or this term or another term. And so they sort of, you know, massage that list of words into producing articles of that are perhaps of interest or connected to the topic that you're searching. And so without those skills, probably there's some respiratory therapists that know how to speak that language, but most of us do not. And so that's where, first off, the librarian is essential. But then once we have the literature review and all the data that comes back, I'll say Joel, our librarian, has been very instrumental assisting us with the reviews in a tool I didn't even mention a second ago, but it is for reference screening, and it's called RAYAN, R-A-Y-A-A-N. It's very similar to Covidence. I did mention that, sort of another reference manager. But with RAYAN, groups have, and two of us, we need at least two team members to screen each PICO question, and these are our research questions, if you will. If I agree to have this article included, but you, Doug, you do not, then we'll set those aside. Once we finish the full screen, then we'll come back to those that we say have conflicts about, and then we'll agree if, okay, this article really doesn't contribute to what we're searching for, we'll discard it, or perhaps it is. So it's just invaluable. We have to have the librarians because they're just invaluable as a part of the team.
Can you share? So I know that you have. You had mentioned the patient ventilator assessment and now the spontaneous breathing trial. Are these scheduled, or is there a schedule or an ETA on when these might be published?
Sure. So on the PVA and the SBT, I suspect that we'll begin writing this summer. We are very close. We've gotten all the articles screened that we are including, and we are beginning now to put that into a table the data into tables so that we can extract what we are needing in terms of our grading of the evidence. Yeah, it's an exciting time. It's also there's a big learning curve, and this is the first time that we've gone through some of these. So that's where we are at this point. But I do think this will go faster than the literature reviewing, because one of our research questions, I mean, it was 15,000 articles that came back. Now, of course, not all of them were relevant, but you know, in terms of casting that big net, that's what we wanted to do, so that, you know, because the worst thing is, oh, you didn't include this article after it's published. We want to do everything we can do to be sure that we are looking at the relevant literature, so that the recommendations that we write and are published are those that we know are up to date and have been rigorously screened and evaluated. And therefore, our members can be very sure about the recommendations that may be helpful for them. But the third group I'll talk about in this one, this topic actually came about from last summer when I attended the journal conference, and it was about, it was a COPD update, if you will. And from there, listening to the speakers and then now reading their papers that will be coming out, there was obviously some gaps from when a patient, a COPD patient, was, say, ordered oxygen for the very first time and then going home with that oxygen. So many times the experience that I have learned is that the patients may have a very good experience with discharge planners at the hospital in the acute care setting, and they go home and a home care company sends a driver out to drop off equipment, and there's nothing further in terms of assistance to that patient in the home. The opposite can be just the case where here you have a patient and maybe there is no discharge planner, or there's one for, you know, 50 people that may be being planned to be discharged that week. And so they're overworked and lack of resources there. So maybe the patient doesn't get the education they need to leave the acute care setting. But then once they get home, hopefully the home care company would be able to pick up any gaps in education and setup and follow up. So there is a point here where we need some guidance on transitioning from the hospital to the home with oxygen. And that's where the chair of this particular CPG group is Mike Hess, who works for the COPD Foundation and was actually one of the authors and speakers at the journal conference last year. He knew of these two patients that we have invited. They have been very active with the COPD Foundation as well with other organizations. One of our members, she is a retired community college professor who 20 years ago realized that exercise was going to keep her alive with her COPD. And then we have a gentleman who lives in Wisconsin, and he, again, has been on oxygen for years and years and years. He was first diagnosed and really told by his physician in his mid-50s that, you know, you don't have long to live. And of course, he's beaten the odds over and over and over at this point. But they have a lot of experience. They are advocates for their community of COPD survivors, we'll say. And they are just wonderful to have on our teams. So good things are happening there. We are still in the literature review stage, but I do think that late December here or late 2023, we'll be writing and finishing up at that point. I'll say about the fourth team, because this is an idea or a goal that I had, and that would be that one day outside organizations or other organizations rather than the ARC would want to partner with us with CPG development. Well, it happened last November, a lot sooner than I thought, but a physician group And they are a network of physicians all across the United States. It's the Pediatric Acute Lung Injury and Sepsis Intervention Network, PALISI Network. They approached one of the members of the patient ventilator assessment team, a pediatric RT at Duke, and asked if the AERC would want to partner with PALISI on a definition and also a CPG. And so I got involved with that. And anyway, we went back and forth there, actually in New Orleans. I met with the physician who approached us, I'll say. And anyway, today we are actively working on a pediatric critical asthma CPG. So again, this is another gap in the literature. We're all familiar with the expert panel asthma guidelines. The last one, the big one, you know, over 500 pages, was released in 2007. And there have been some small updates since that time. But most of the asthma guidelines relate to practice outside of an acute care setting. Yes, there are some guidelines for emergency care and some for ICU and intubation mortality and things like that. But for a lot of pediatric clinicians, when you have, someone come in the emergency department, maybe they become stabilized, but they're still in such a critical state that so you begin to run out of options. In other words, you know, we have now thought about Heliox and non-invasive ventilation and continuous albuterol. I mean, there are some treatment plans now, but they haven't really been studied for the evidence totally. So that's where we are. We started our first meeting last month. There are four research questions related particularly to respiratory care. And then there's some four other questions that are more pharmacologically related to asthma than anything else. And so there's an RT, there is a physician with the PICO questions, and so far it is going just fabulously. And so we're at the point now we're getting our keywords together to give to the librarians. In fact, now we have a group of three librarians working on this, two from the PALISI they're not from PALISI, but they work with the physicians who are at that institution. This is in Indiana. So, I mean, this happens a lot faster than I thought, but with the leadership from the AERC and the RTs that are on the team here, it is going quite well so far. And so I'm very happy about that. So if this is successful, I do foresee that other outside organizations will want to join with us in the future. And that is so important for the profession, that because we have had some RTs on other organizations' practice guidelines, but now they're coming to us to ask to be a part of that. And that is the wonderful thing about this. I'm thinking now about my next one that will be, that should get underway probably in May. And so I did put out a call on AERC Connect for ideas, and I did receive some. And one of them I'm really looking at carefully to see if this is appropriate. Is it possible? Is it doable? So anyway, yeah, I hope that everyone can see that we're not taking this lightly, this responsibility that we have, and that the evidence that is produced will be very timely and helpful for RTs whenever it comes.
So is that going to, because that was one area that I wanted to talk about, is what is the process in identifying which new CPGs are going to be placed into the queue? And you had just chatted that you put a call out for AARC membership to provide, you know, recommendations. Is that going to be the process moving forward, or is it multifaceted?
Yeah, there's a lot of things going in, a lot of moving pieces. So on Connect, I really only reached out to the leadership and management as well as the education section. It's not to say that I'm not interested in the other sections, but I wanted to hear mainly from managers who are in our hospital systems, acute care, what clinical questions do they have? you know, I was an academic for a long time, and I had been removed from the hospital setting for some time. I mean, I'm still a respiratory therapist, but those most pressing questions that particularly that probably came from COVID, a lot of them now, you know, I wanted to get their input. But yes, there are other ways as well for the questions to come. And again, me going to listen to other lectures that we had at Congress this past time, and then I'll definitely be going this coming year or this later this year. That's where ideas come about as well. Seems to be working. And but I probably at some point will need to create some sort of template for people to complete if they should have an idea, so that I know kind of what they're thinking as opposed to just a general topic, because sometimes this big, huge topic can have various facets to it. And maybe there's something in particular that they're wanting to know or needing to know, and we can just zero in on it.
Linda, we are kind of at the bottom of the hour. I do have one more really critical question that I'd like to ask. So our members, hopefully we're going to have these CPGs published here in the not too distant future, hopefully sometime later in 2023. But as our, whether it's an existing clinical practice guideline or a new one that you're working on, if we have a listener out there who is fascinated about wanting to learn more about this, and they read a clinical practice guideline, could you offer some insight on, you know, maybe best practices or how do you take what is the written word in a scientific publication and actually incorporate it into practice? Now, that could be a podcast all in its own. But if you were to just highlight, you know, maybe three or four steps, that here are some of the things that you need to focus on from taking what's published and incorporating it into practice.
Yes, and that's a great question, because the CPGs will produce recommendations, and the recommendations will also tell you how strong these recommendations are based on the literature, or if they're weak recommendations because there's just not enough literature there to make a stronger recommendation. So that's where I would recommend starting. Look at the recommendations whenever they are published, because that is where managers in particular, they can take that and then make that work for their department. That is one of the things that a CPG will not do. It will not tell you how to do things. It just recommends practice. And how you do it at your particular institution is up to you and that department and the institution. Every institution, we know this, every medical center is different. Yes, we practice respiratory therapy, but we all do it in different ways. We get to the same input, but it's, you know, it's culture of the organization that drives some of this. And therefore, if you take a recommendation, fit that into your culture and into your department, that's where I suggest beginning. Now, it could be that once you get this recommendation, it may be that there are some skills that your therapist don't have. Well, then now you know how to go and advocate for them to get these skills. It could be that you're doing things that the recommendations is weak on, but yet you're doing a lot of treatments with this particular modality. Maybe now's the time to say, you know, perhaps we need to pull back and not do this as much because it is weak evidence that we're seeing. Let's look at what is more rigorous or what may be a better practice than what we're doing now. So that's why I say these are recommendations. It is not telling you how to do things. That's up to you. And I that was, again, one of the reasons I reached out to the management and leadership section, because I'm sure that they are overworked and lack of staffing right now, as we try to come out completely from COVID. And so instead of working harder, I'm hoping that these recommendations will allow you to work smarter and focus on other things like our patients and their well-being.
Great, great feedback. I could not have answered that question better, and I'm glad you did. I'm certainly not qualified to answer that. Like that question like you did, and you did it very eloquently. Linda, before I let you go, I think that our listeners would be very disappointed in me if I did not ask the question about the patient ventilator assessment. Will there be a recommendation for frequency coming out with a new guideline? There will not. Okay. Yeah. Fair enough.
Yes. Fair enough. Don't ask.
Were there any questions, Linda, today that I didn't ask that I should have?
I think we covered it all here. I'd made some notes, and it looks like I hit on everything I intended to. So thank you, Doug.
Absolutely. Well, Linda, thank you so much. We look forward to your continued work in this area and hopefully on the publications that will be coming out later this year, as well as the continued work that you do on your two newer CPGs that you're working on. Thanks so much for joining us today.
I appreciate the time. Thanks. Bye.
And thank you for listening. Coming to you from Studio 1A in Irving, Texas at the AARC headquarters. Thanks so much for listening. And just remember, when you can't breathe, nothing else matters. Thanks so much, everyone.
Thanks for listening to AARC Perspectives. Be sure to check out our show notes page for information about today's episode, as well as links to our other podcast episodes. Be sure to know when our next episode airs by subscribing to our podcast. Until next time, my friends, keep on supporting the respiratory therapy profession.